But it had very little public support. It was arbitrary in nature, it was clearly repressive, it used force against any of its critics, and any residual public support that Condé might have had up to that point was rapidly eroded by the nasty behavior of his administration. And indeed, on the 14th of October, 1652, taking advantage of one of Condé's temporary absences from Paris, the royalists mounted a coup in the city and recaptured the city. Within a week, Louis XIV would return to his capital, and Condé fled. He fled France altogether, and somewhat ironically, now offered his services to the Spanish crown against his own country. By the summer of 1653, the last rebel outpost in the Fronde of the Princes, which was the city of Bordeaux, had capitulated to royal forces, and the rebellion was over. Now, as I mentioned a little earlier, the Fronde of the Princes had a number of elements in it which I think we can only describe as fairly bizarre, or at least laughable. Just to take a few examples, the Viscount of Turenne, another illustrious French general during the Thirty Years' War, actually joined the rebels in the year 1650, not because of any political principle or objection to the way he'd been treated, but largely because of his infatuation with the Duchess of Longueville, who was Condé's sister, and this the spectacle of this old gray-bearded gentleman, general, you know, sort of falling in love with this young woman and therefore joining the rebels, I think is, you know, gives us a sense of how farcical the revolt of the princes often was. Just to give you another example, I mentioned that Condé lost the battle outside of Paris in 1652, but nonetheless succeeded in capturing the city. The reason for this was that the king's own cousin, a fairly formidable woman by the name of Anne-Marie Montpensier de Bourbon, herself ordered the garrison of the Bastille, this French royal fortress, to turn its guns on the royal army, and she seems to have had a sufficiently commanding presence to convince them to do so, and this allowed to, Condé to sneak into the city. But rather than get lost in these details, entertaining though they might be, I think it's more useful to construct an interpretation of the causes of the outbreak, and indeed, and in particular, an explanation of why the revolt ultimately failed. And as with the Fronde of the Parlement, with the uprising of the judges against the French monarchy, I think it's helpful to look at two different features of the revolt of the princes. First of all, its ideological foundations, and second of all, the actual realities of power, the power constellations which obtained in France in this period. To begin with ideology, it is striking, it seems to me, that absolutely none of the movements of nobiliary resistance were able to generate any kind of republican ideal or even quasi-republican ideal. Indeed, as far as we can tell, there isn't even any familiarity with these republican ideals of the late 16th century in the various manifestos generated by the aristocracy. They were never able, in other words, to generate any real ideological alternative to the idea of divine right monarchy. And here again we have a striking contrast with the French Wars of Religion in the late 16th century, when Jesuit theorists and other members of the Catholic League, indeed, and before them, some of the Huguenot rebels against the French crown are perfectly able to put together theories of popular sovereignty, constitutional principles pursuant to which the people can depose or get rid of a monarch if he rules to their detriment. The nobiliary rebels of the 1640s and 1650s are completely unable to do this. Instead, far from generating any republican ideals, nobiliary politics were pervaded by really conservative ideas, deeply conservative ideas, and ideas which revolved around the preservation of the traditional status of the aristocracy. In fact, if we look at the actual objectives of these princely frondeurs, they're fairly revealing. They wanted to wrest control of the royal council from the king's chief minister, this fellow by the name of Cardinal Mazarin. They also wanted to protect the military and material bases of their own lineages with the usual sources, positions, pensions, marriage alliances, and so on and so forth. To give you an example, we know from the surviving documentation that in the year 1649, the Prince of Conti, one of the rebels against the crown, what he wanted more than anything else was a place in the Council of State, that is to say, a place on the Council of the State which he was himself opposing, and he also wanted to have a fortress in his governorship in the province of Champagne. The Duke of Longueville, another one of the aristocratic opponents, wanted a fortress in his governorship of Normandy, and he wanted the right to resign his own position as governor in favor of his sons. In sum, and here again I think we're going to be reminiscent of the situation of the Parlement, far from trying to overthrow the state, far from trying to change its form, the princely magnates were simply at odds with Mazarin, the chief minister to the crown, and indeed at times at odds with each other over the division of the spoils which the state itself generated. The Fronde of the Princes was a struggle between ins and outs, not a struggle between ideological enemies. At times it takes on fairly, almost embarrassing overtones of a crass struggle for a place at the trough, for the goodies provided by the French crown.